Okay, we're in Genesis chapter 9. And remember, we're dealing with four major controversies that pop up at the end of Genesis chapter 9. And by the way, we're not doing this to be controversial. We're doing this to be provocative. We're also doing this to, well, in this sense, non-Christians are bothered by these issues. And I think what disturbs them most of all as they look at us Christians is individuals who are trying to run from these controversies and pretend they don't exist. And I had a few of you come up to me a couple of weeks ago and say, you know, just thank you for talking about Noah getting drunk, because that's typically an issue that Christians say, gee, I really don't want to deal with that one, and they duck it. But it is an issue that non-Christians are concerned about, and we do need to deal with it. And it was kind of fun, at least from my perspective, going through the whole Bible and seeing what it says about drinking wine. Get a perspective from Genesis to Revelation on drinking wine. But there are three more controversies in the text. You know, we dealt with the issue, is this fermentation for the first time, and what does the Bible say about drinking wine? We're now talking about the curse that was pronounced by Noah upon Canaan. I mean, here is Ham that did the dastardly deed, but guess who gets cursed? It's Canaan that gets cursed. And then we'll be looking at the controversy about how could Noah live so long after the flood. I mean, he lived 600 years before the flood, but he lived another 350 years after the flood. And what about his sons? They lived quite a long time too, and how did you square that with a shortening of human lifespans down to a maximum of 120 years in Genesis 6:3. And then finally, the issue of slavery. I mean, a lot of non-Christians look at these last few verses of Genesis 9, and they often presume that the text is condoning slavery. So we will do that. But in terms of the curse on Canaan, Genesis 10, as we discussed last week, kind of talks about the population's explosion from the three sons of Noah and where these peoples wound up. And it's in the context of Genesis chapter 11. Kind of what's going on in the history of humanity up to this point is you've got one world government with one nation, one people that's at peace with one another in terms of at least national peace, but not personal peace. The problem is, if you have national peace without personal peace with God, then there's no personal peace of the people living in that kind of situation. And so one of the things God does is he says, we're going to have antitrust legislation. We're going to have nations competing with one another for citizens. And this is how we're going to set it up. Well, what you've got in Genesis chapter 10 is what's called the Table of the Nations. And it documents how the people spread out from Mesopotamia to all the parts of the earth. And there's been a huge amount of debate on this as to, you know, who are the Americans? Who are the British? Who are the Swedes? Can we find them in this list here? What about the Chinese? And it can be difficult. But I'd like to suggest that in terms of the Hamites and the Canaanites, it's not that difficult. So that's a question I got for you here. Who are the Hamites, based on Genesis chapter 10? And who are the Canaanites, based on Genesis chapter 10? And we may not get to this today, but one we're going to follow up on. What does Genesis chapter 10 tell us about the fate of Noah's Ark? Ever hear people debate about the fate of Noah's Ark? Hey, there's a thing on television on the fate of Noah's Ark. But I noticed in watching that two-hour television documentary on CBS and PAX and other networks, they never addressed the content of Genesis chapter 10. They were all back there in Genesis 7 and 8. Didn't look very much at Genesis chapter 9 and none at all at Genesis chapter 10. I think you can resolve this by looking at what Genesis chapter 10 has got to say. So that's kind of what's on our plate for today. And we did do some discussion a couple of weeks ago on how come we have Ham doing the dastardly deed and Canaan winds up getting the curse. And I have to point out one more thing before I have you dig into Genesis chapter 10. what we see in the last few verses of Genesis chapter 9 is God pronounces through Noah a blessing on his son Shem and his son Japheth and a curse on Canaan, but he says nothing whatsoever about Ham. Ham does not get blessed. Ham does not get cursed. He's dropped off the list. Canaan gets the curse, not the other sons of Ham. And then Shem and Japheth both receive a blessing, a slightly different blessing. And then we have the reference to Canaan being the slave of Shem. And so last time we discussed this, a lot of you, I think, correctly put it in the prophetic context, that sometimes when God is pronouncing blessings through the patriarchs, it's not so much the father saying, you know, son, I really like you, you did a good job, and you're going to be rewarded. Son, you're not doing so well, and you're going to suffer some consequences. Often what's really going on is that God is simply telling through the patriarch what's going to happen to the descendants 400, 500, 1,000 years, 2,000 years hence. And so I think a lot of you are on target that what God was doing in this few verses here at the end of Genesis chapter 9 is projecting hundreds and thousands of years into the future as to what will be the fate of Shem and Japheth, of Canaan, and you know, again, Ham doesn't even get mentioned. What's going on with Ham? And I think that's a big part of the controversy, is people have tried to take what the text does not say about Ham and draw all kinds of conclusions. So let's dive into this and see if we can explore what the roots of the controversy are. Who are the Hamites? What do we get out of this Genesis chapter 10? Now, I'll give you a little hint here. As you go down the table of nations, you get all these names. Problem is, it's difficult to associate the names with the geographical location and with the people group. And by the way, that's part of the debate that's going on here. Is this Genesis chapter 10 a discussion about geography, or is it a discussion about people groups? Maybe we should identify that right off the bat and move on from there. I think I got this backwards. There we go. Now I got it right. Okay. So who votes for geography and who votes for people? You already voted for people, okay? Some said both. I see. Yeah, you want to say something, Norm, or no? People, okay? Yeah, a lot of you got Bibles where you flip to the back, there's a little map. Oh, right there in the text, and it shows you where all those people went. Yeah, I've seen that in a couple of study Bibles where they'll actually give you two maps. Yes. These are the descendants of Ham by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. So I think this is where people say, well, maybe it's geography, maybe it's people group, maybe it's language group, maybe it's all three. Problem is, people move around. And one of my study Bibles, it actually gives you two maps. A map just like yours, where it kind of shows the spread of these peoples throughout this area here. I think your map is kind of the same as this map here. And then it shows a worldwide map, which is where those peoples are presumed to be now. Yeah, that's great, but how accurate is it? So, and that's part of what was going on. And actually, as you read here in the text, it talks about the movement of these people. For example, of the three sons, which is the one that moves around the most? Not Ham. Not Shem. That leaves who? Japheth. Japheth is the wanderer. It was his descendants that really began the colonization program of moving out to the... Because that was God's command, multiply and fill the earth. Well, it was the Japhites that took that the most seriously, about packing the bags, leaving Mesopotamia, and beginning to move over the face of the earth. But the peoples did tend to move in three different directions. So, back to Ham. My whole point is of the three sons, it's the territories of the sons of Ham and the peoples of the sons of Ham that are most easy to identify from the text. My wife, Kathy, who's not well today, that's why she's not here, she made a prediction. She says, Hugh, you need to realize that people probably don't have geography the way that people did, say, 50, 60 years ago. So that'd be a little tip. Where are these places? Okay, you're talking about Cush. Yeah, Cush was the father of Nimrod, and it talks about all the cities he built in the territory of Assyria and Babylon, Nineveh, quite a bit east of Israel. But this is a spread out from Mesopotamia. That would seem to indicate that they didn't move much. But how about we go up to verse 6? The sons of Ham. Who are the sons of Ham? Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Does anybody who is good in geography recognize what those names refer to in terms of territories? Yeah, Mitzrayim is the ancient name for Egypt. That's good. If you've been to Egypt, you may have flown on Mizar Airlines. It's M-I-Z-R, and it's taken right out of this name. So even today, the Egyptians consider themselves the descendants of Mitzrayim. Now, when we were there, I found out that Mizar Airlines was actually referred to by everybody as Misery Airlines, but it really is M-I-Z-R. And how about Cush and Put and Canaan? Anybody good in geography can tell us where those places are? Okay, now you're getting there. In ancient Egypt, the land of Cush was to the south of Egypt. And if you read the book of Exodus, it speaks about these Cushites as being people that were tall and slender and of very dark skin. So this is where the term came from, students of the Bible centuries ago, that the Cushites were the blacks. And yes, the land of Ethiopia and Sudan and other parts of Africa became the territory of the Cushites. And what about Put? Yeah, there's a people group in Ethiopia that claims their descent back to the Queen of Sheba, and therefore they claim to be Jews. And actually, there is some DNA evidence to support that. And so Israelis are admitting those people as Jews. And so you got dark-skinned Jews and light-skinned Jews. But it dates back to the time of Solomon's court. Okay. Anybody else? Yes. Queen of Sheba was from Ethiopia. If you read Kings, it identifies her as the Queen of Ethiopia or the Queen of Sheba. So you had a good chance she was black. So, how good a chance? All right. Yeah, whatever. Okay. Now, some of your Bibles will have a different name there for Cush. Some English translations actually put the word Ethiopia in there rather than the word Cush. And likewise, there's some that put an alternate name in for the name Put. Anybody got one of those Bibles? What's the alternate name that you'll see in some translations for Put? That'll make it really easy for you to figure out what's going on there. Huh? That's right. Yeah, some translations will put the term Libya in there. Now, we shouldn't look at the biblical Libya as identical to the modern-day Libya. Likewise, we shouldn't look at Cush as identical to the modern-day Ethiopia. They're both much bigger territories. Put would refer to the territory of northern Africa, east of Egypt. So it would run from Libya to Morocco and even on down. The whole Sahara Desert and the area north of the Sahara Desert would be the peoples in the territory of Put. That part that's south of the Sahara Desert and south of Egypt would be the territory of Cush. Now, there are some Bible scholars who made the point I heard from right here to the effect that Well, what about the Cushites that were in Babylon? What happened to them? Well, there's been some speculation that maybe those Cushites went into India. After all, you've got dark-skinned people there in India and Southeast Asia. And that was the basis for the speculation that all the Hamites were very dark-skinned people. But the problem is the Libyans are not dark-skinned people. So it doesn't totally fit. Yes. Okay. If you go back 100, 200 years, it was really popular for Christians to go down this table of nations and identify all these people as to the color of their skin. You know, red, yellow, black, white, that was done. But there's no biblical support for that. This is simply people going down the table of nations saying, well, the Cushites are black, therefore the Hamites must all be dark-skinned peoples. But if you go back into ancient Egypt, the sons and daughters of Mitzrayim were typically very light-skinned. And so that's not consistent with that. Likewise, the Libyans or the Putnians were not as dark-skinned as the Ethiopians. And it's quite speculative that maybe the people in Southeast Asia are also descendants of the Cush. Could be, but who's to prove that? The only thing you get out of the Bible is this. There's no mention of racial diversity until you get to the book of Exodus. And the first reference to racial diversity is the wife of Moses. He was light-skinned and she was dark-skinned. And there was some actual racial prejudice expressed there in the Exodus text. Remember, Moses was criticized for having a dark-skinned wife. So that's the first reference we have of racial diversity in the text. As you move on into the Bible, particularly in Kings, you do see references to racial diversity, but nothing in the book of Genesis. So it's completely speculative, based on the text, when the racial diversity was imposed. Now, the question you ask, I did address in the Genesis question. Is it possible that God's got nothing to do with this racial diversity, and it's purely the result of natural forces of selection? I mean, if you go to the equator, you're going to get a tan, okay? And maybe the people that are best adapted to tanning are going to prefer to live there, whereas those of us that are melanin challenged will say, the equator's not for me, and we will tend to go to Norway, okay? I mean, that could have happened. But I argue in the Genesis question that there simply isn't enough driving force of natural selection to make that explanation viable, because what you have are people living in the wrong place. The Eskimos are relatively dark-skinned, and they chose to remain in the Arctic. You know, they could have wandered down to the Amazon, but that's not what happened. They stayed up there in the Arctic. So in that case, you got the wrong color in the wrong place. And then the biggest problem of all is not so much that the human species is racially diverse, but that the races, until recently, have remained separated in their different geographies. I mean, again, given how little pressure there is from the natural environment for geography to relate to skin color, you'd expect that the races would become rather quickly mixed up. And that didn't happen, at least until recently. And the whole point there is that having white skin doesn't really give you a big enough penalty for living in the tropics. Even without modern technology, people could survive in the tropics with light skin. They may have to wear a hat more frequently than people with dark skin, but, I mean, that's relatively low technology for dealing with a light skin problem. And likewise, if you're in the Arctic, what you discover is that the people with dark skin don't have to eat significantly more food than people with light skin. I mean, put people with different races down at a dinner table, and it's really hard to detect any difference in the amount of food that they consume to maintain the color of their skin. And so given that that is so slight, you know, how can we say that this is all done through natural forces? And likewise, the vitamin D issue has often been raised. Well, the lighter skin you have, the more easily you can pull vitamin D from sunlight into your body. but again, the difference isn't great enough to explain the racial diversity. Something else is explaining the racial diversity. In my opinion, God's got something to do with it. And I prefer to stick it into Genesis chapter 11, but there's nothing in the text to prove it, other than the fact that God is obviously interested in setting up competition amongst the nations. And perhaps, in addition to the geographical separations and the language separations, perhaps racial diversity was one tool to try to keep the nations separate so that they would compete with one another. One of the things that kind of pushes me in that direction, again, as a student of geography, you look at the globe, and isn't it amazing how the continents have been laid out by God so that there's so many natural geographical borders? I mean, you've got mountains in just the right places, you've got rivers in just the right places, and you've got sea coasts and straits in the places that really facilitates maintaining separate nations that indeed would be competing one another for their citizens. So I look at the way the seven continents are distributed and the mountains and the rivers are distributed and the deserts as no accident. It seems to be rather idealized to make lots of different places for different nations to maintain their independent existence. Of course, today we're breaking it down with modern technology, but put yourself in the context of people living 1,000 years ago, and those geographical barriers are really quite significant. Okay, there's a question over here somewhere. Yes. Okay, well, you're raising the issue. How much time would you need to try to explain this racial diversity through the forces of natural selection? You know, a whole lot more time than the amount of time the human species has been on the planet. That's kind of what I argue in the Genesis question. If you try to say this is all natural, and the geography would help, the languages would help, but there simply isn't enough time to make the races that distinct and that geographically separated if all you're working with is 50,000 years. Okay, what was it that kept the people moving? We're going to address that in Genesis chapter 11. I think a lot of it is kind of God sitting there with a stick saying, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Because what we see in Genesis chapter 11, it seems to be the natural tendency of human beings outside of the authority of Jesus Christ to, hey, I'm not moving. I'm staying put. So, in fact, we see that a lot even today, right? I mean, yeah. What makes us move today, I think, is economic opportunity. And again, I think there's another reason why God wanted lots of separate nations that were independent and competing with one another as another motivation to get people distributed. So economic opportunity is a big part of it, but I think what we see in the text is God actually had to force people out of Mesopotamia into the different parts of the earth. You know, once they got moving, then I think things took care of itself. So, but good question, yes. Yeah, that's really quite amazing, given the tumultuous history of Egypt, that you still have this line. But Egyptians actually accept that, even before the DNA analysis, that they are indeed the descendants of Mitzrayim. Yes. There was a history teacher that actually could link himself back to these people that lived in Britain 10,000 years ago. Yeah, pretty amazing. Okay, so yeah, there is this tendency to stay put. Yes. Well, this is what we just heard, is that people have done DNA analysis on modern Egyptians and compared it with Egyptians taken out of these ancient tombs from the pyramids, and there's a link. Oh, we can't go back to Mitzrayim himself, no. We can't identify the body of Mitzrayim, but the early descendants of Mitzrayim, which we're talking 3,000 years ago, those individuals have been dug up and their DNA compared with modern Egyptians. But not Mitzrayim, no. We haven't been able to go back 5,000 years. Yeah. Okay, in terms of this mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome analysis, keep in mind it's only been exploited in the last 3 years. Well, I mean, it's been applied to just a few people groups on the planet and always with small numbers of individuals. But hey, This is going to be an exciting way to trace human development in the next few years. And this is where I think we Christians can say, no, wait a minute, we already have this table of nations, we can check this out. So, but for example, with Jewish people, they can now use Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA analysis to determine, at least roughly, who are Jews and who are not. And even who are the descendants of Aaron amongst the Jews and who are not. So that could be a real helpful tool for fulfilling some Bible prophecy you see in the book of Ezekiel. Okay, Ross. Okay, that is something that people do speculate about. Did Adam and Eve have all the genes necessary to explain the racial diversity in just a few generations of following Adam and Eve? Like, that's the kicker. Trying to make it happen in just a few generations would be really difficult. So personally, I believe there's some supernatural input from God that explains the racial diversity, not just so much the racial diversity, the geographical separation of the races. Naturalists don't typically see this as a problem because they're prepared to spread it out over millions of years. Okay, but now that we have evidence that the origin of humanity dates to only a few tens of thousands of years, and in that context, it would be a big problem. I would argue it's a problem even in millions of years. Yes, Wes. Well, breeding speeds it up, and that is one response that people have given to what we see here in Genesis 10 and 11. They say it's not God supernaturally messing with our gene pool. What's going on is that God does some artificial breeding. And so somewhere in this period of time, he would be saying, well, you know, you're not going to marry this individual. You're going to marry this individual. So forget that gal. You're going to marry this gal. And he was doing that with millions of people all at once, and that's how we get the racial diversity. And that's a plausible answer. Now, you either have to have some strong artificial breeding going on, or you got the input of genetic diversity. But just leaving it to natural reproductive forces, in my opinion, you're not going to explain the racial diversity. Yes. They could, but the trick is trying to capitalize on it so that you can explain the distribution of human beings today. And, you know, it's a big difference. I mean, the reason we have all these dog breeds is because there's been strong artificial breeding going on. You know, it's we human beings have come in there and says, we're just not going to let them mate any way they want. We're going to separate them into these different characteristics. And even then, it takes a long time. And you've got to impose this artificial breeding for many, many generations to get all these breeds. And hey, if you leave them alone, what happens? They revert. This is one place where it's relevant, right? Because the generations are shorter for dogs, you can make things happen faster. But the problem, you know, one of the criticisms I would have of the breeding experiment by God is you have to sustain this for a long time, because that's one of the things, is that you lose your diversity of dog breeds if you don't maintain the human control. And so you'd have to argue that God's been maintaining this control for thousands of years, preventing us from marrying the people we want in order to maintain this diversity. No, I haven't, but we got Richard here. He's a biologist, so, I mean, do you know anything about the propensity of different genomes for breeding? Right. So, because I think with the dogs, at least you've got a few different species mixing together, which helps. You know, wolves and foxes and dingoes and all that, whereas with humans, you've got much less to work with. Yeah, we're running out of time. Okay. Well, that is another piece of speculation that's brought into the text, is that, hey, you got this relatively small human population, but zap them with lots of cosmic rays, and you're going to get mutations, and maybe that explains the racial diversity. That's a possibility, certainly, yes. Sure. I mean, that's again, the artificial breeding thing, okay? All of those of you that are speaking French, we're going to make sure you're all of the same gene type. So we might take people of the same gene type and say, you're going to be the French speakers and you're going to be the Hindu speakers, etc. You know, that could be done. But again, you're kind of left with this choice. Something supernatural or some kind of breeding taking place. Hey, we're going to cover this a little bit more detail when we get to Genesis chapter 11. Do want to wrap things up. And hey, we never got to identifying who the Canaanites are. They're the easiest ones of the lot. Why? Because you get a list of the sons of Canaan, and that list of sons shows up again and again and again throughout the Bible text. So that's really easy. And I guess what makes it non-controversial is that they're all gone. So it's not something we can use to express our racial prejudice today. But that's one of the problems with the sons of Ham, is people are trying to take this data out of the Bible and use it as a justification for racial prejudice. At least in terms of the Canaanites, we solve that by the fact that they're not even here anymore. So, but it'd be good to look into the reason. Why are they not here? That ties in with a curse. Well, we'll bring this up next time. We're also going to look at Genesis chapter 10 and how this pertains to the controversy over the remains of Noah's Ark. Father in heaven, we thank you that even in the genealogies, even in these lists of nations, Lord, there's content that we can use to settle our differences and content that we can use to show people that this indeed is the Word of God and gives us the message for life, both here and in the new creation that follows. So, Lord, make us wise as we go through these texts. Help us to help one another. Help us to expose creative ways of looking at both the record of nature and the words of the Bible, that we may learn something we don't learn already. But most of all, help us to apply what we're learning, that we may be better followers of you and more submissive to